From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Religious groups meet in Colorado to support gay and lesbian people in the church. The State Department denies security clearance to congressional aides for a trip to Iraq. Does the U.S. plan to escalate the bombing of that country? Meanwhile, Iraqi workers in Nebraska are suing their employer for racial discrimination. And finally, grassroots groups meet to discuss the future of community-sponsored non-commercial radio. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders. First, these news headlines. The Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal announced today that Austrian police arrested the top Bosnian Serb military commander on UN charges of persecuting Bosnian Croats and Muslims in a bloody 1992 ethnic purge. Mumir Kalic, chief of staff of the Bosnian Serb army, was charged in a sealed indictment with war crimes against humanity, namely persecutions on political, racial or religious grounds, Tribunal Chief Prosecutor Louise Arbour told reporters in The Hague. The indictment, which also charges former Bosnian Serb Deputy Prime Minister Radislav Brajin, accuses the two of ordering, implementing and assisting in a plan designed, quote-unquote, to expel the Bosnian Muslim, Bosnian Croat and other non-Serb populations. In Turkey, the Prime Minister has promised stricter building rules to prevent the shoddy construction blamed for the thousands of deaths from last week's massive earthquake. 8 days after the powerful 7.4 magnitude quake reduced much of western Turkey to rubble, an estimated 200,000 survivors remain camped out in parks and on vacant lots. For a second night, they were drenched with heavy rain. Auschwitz historians have proven that Ford vehicles were used at the Nazi death camp, but have found no evidence that the company used inmates as slave laborers, a museum official has said yesterday. Ford Motor Company is among about 500 companies mentioned in Nazi documents the Auschwitz Museum recently received from Russia. Soviet troops took part of the camp archive after liberating the camp in 1945. Ford's U.S. headquarters has acknowledged that slave labor was used at its Cologne plant during World War II, but says it lost control of its German operations during the war. Apart from Ford's German subsidiary, German industrial giants such as Krupp, Siemens, and IJ Farben are also named in the newly available documents. Hundreds of supporters greeted an Italian returning to Rome today to serve her sentence for helping to plan armed robberies to finance leftist guerrillas in the United States. Sylvia Baraldini had already served 16 years on conspiracy and racketeering charges. She is scheduled for mandatory release in 2008. Premier Massimo D'Alema's center-left coalition government had worked doggedly to persuade the U.S. to allow Baraldini to serve the last 9 years of that sentence in Rome. Authorities say she participated in a string of 16 robberies and attempted robberies that included the 1981 holdup of a Brinks truck near Nyack, New York, in which a guard and two police officers were killed. Speaking yesterday, Justice Minister Oliviero Di Liberto said these are moments of happiness. Several Italian cities and towns, from Palermo to the resort island of Ischia, have offered Baraldini honorary citizenship, calling her a symbol of U.S. injustice. A federal judge has struck down one of the nation's oldest school voucher programs, one that allowed Cleveland students to attend private or parochial schools at taxpayer expense. With many city schools opening today, district officials braced for the possibility of having to absorb thousands of children cut off from private schools. Supporters plan to appeal Tuesday's ruling by U.S. District Judge Solomon Oliver Jr., whose injunction halted the voucher program until a trial determines whether it violates the constitutional separation of church and state. The judge said the program appeared to have the primary effect of advancing religion because most of the 56 participating schools are religious institutions. A conservative group is warning of a growing threat to the country's national parks. The National Park Trust is out with a report today saying that millions of acres of private property inside the boundaries of national parks are in danger of being developed. It says on any given day, 200,000 acres are under immediate threat. The California legislature has sent to Governor Gray Davis a bill that would let cities and counties set up needle exchange programs for drug addicts. Current state laws bar such programs, but four California cities, Berkeley, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Santa Cruz, and Marin County, have adopted emergency ordinances allowing needle exchanges. Davis's office said the Democratic governor has not taken a position on the bill, which passed the state Senate yesterday. At least 15 other states have authorized needle exchange programs, although there are exchange programs in more than twice that many states, according to Assemblywoman Carrie Mazzoni's office. You're listening to Democracy Now! My name is Laura Flanders. With me here today, co-hosting as always on a Wednesday, is Juan Gonzalez of New York Daily News. Juan, good morning.
Good day, Laura, and it's good to be with you now that Amy is on assignment in trying to get into East Timor.
Well, last thing we heard, she had been deported by the Indonesian officials right at the airport. We spoke to her yesterday on this program. She's not back here yet, though, so who knows where she is?
Well, I'm sure that she's resourceful enough to figure out what to do next.
We're going to talk today about a situation that appears to be changing in nature, although it's consistent in tone, namely the U.S. relationship with Iraq. The U.S. military yesterday denied attacking civilian sites in that country after the Iraqi government accused it of having killed two people in the town of Bashekwa, several hundred miles north of Baghdad. Speaking from a U.S. base in Ankara, Turkey, a U.S. military spokesperson said that that two people had probably died from falling Iraqi anti-aircraft rounds and not from bombs fired by Allied planes, blaming the Iraqis, in effect, for killing themselves. The U.S. and Britain have dropped hundreds of missiles on northern and southern Iraq since late December, killing dozens of people, maybe into the hundreds, according to the Iraqi officials. And this is despite the fact that the U.N. Security Council has never authorized these attacks. And some Security Council members now, led by France, are criticizing the bombings and working on a resolution to end the economic sanctions that are responsible for the deaths of thousands of Iraqis every month. France and the U.S. could come to a head at the Security Council over this issue soon. As we recently reported on Democracy Now!, a new UNICEF study says that infant and child mortality in Iraq has more than doubled in the last 10 years. The sanctions are now into their ninth year, and France hopes to convince council members to lift them. With us here in the studio to talk about both the sanctions situation and the situation with respect to the so-called no-fly zones is Farhan Fak, who is a United Nations correspondent for the Interpress Service, a Third World News Service. He's here with us in WBAI studios in New York. Farhan, welcome to the program.
Hi. Nice to see you again.
We have been getting sort of sporadic reports about the French criticisms of the U.S., British, and Turkish-imposed program of no-fly zone incursions. What do you know about that, and is it the same type of measure? Is the measure criticizing the sanctions connected with that one, or are they two separate initiatives?
Well, in a way, they are two separate initiatives. But in one major respect, both of them are tied into the general feeling of dissatisfaction with the UN Security Council's policy on Iraq, which has been virtually unchanged since August 1990, which is when Iraq invaded Kuwait. For the last 9 years, the sanctions have remained on Iraq, even though practically every nation except the United States and Britain has deemed the sanctions to be ineffective and harmful to Iraq. And at the same time, of course, the enforcement of the no-fly zones, which was also never authorized by the UN Security Council, by the way, has come in for greater criticism, particularly among third world nations, but also increasingly among some of the more powerful Security Council members, Russia and China in the past, and now over the past year, even France. France's change in posture is particularly important because France, along with the US and Britain, had been enforcing the no-fly zone for so many years. However, since last December, France has not been participating in these very frequent, basically weekly attacks by the U.S. and Britain, in which, by the way, more munitions have been dropped since last December in this particular conflict than was dropped in Yugoslavia during the actual war in Kosovo.
How come there has not been much attention to the French position, and why has it been so, seems muted almost in terms of its opposition?
Well, in some ways it is muted. France is more concerned, it seems, about lifting the sanctions than it is about the no-fly zone. Even though a number of countries such as France, Russia, and also Malaysia, which is a non-permanent member, which is sitting on the Security Council this year, have repeatedly criticized these regular bombings. For most of the countries that sit on the Security Council right now, the big goal is lifting sanctions. And this is where France and other countries have devoted considerable energy towards trying to craft some proposal where if Iraq were to allow some degree of weapons inspections, there haven't been any since last December, then Iraq would be rewarded with the lifting of all of the UN sanctions. Unfortunately, that position is still not accepted by the U.S. and Britain, who are proposing a different sort of approach where if Iraq were to cooperate with some disarmament tasks up front and allow inspections, they would be rewarded with the lifting only of the sanctions on export. In other words, Iraq would then be allowed to export as much oil as they want, which is their primary export. Since Iraq is already taking advantage of an exemption that the UN has granted them, the so-called oil for food deal, to sell billions of dollars of oil every year, they are in many ways already taking advantage of the ability to sell their oil as much as their pipelines, as much as their infrastructure will allow them to. So, to a certain extent, it's unlikely that Iraq would view the lifting of export sanctions as any major step forward.
And Farhan Haq, that question does raise the bigger one, which is you can say you may sell as much oil as you want, but if you don't have the means to repair your equipment to be able to produce the oil, as far as I understand it, Iraq is producing it kind of highest possible in the highest possible volume given the situation of disrepair under the sanctions.
Oh, yeah. Iraq's infrastructure is clearly falling apart. A number of UN officials that I've spoken to have wondered why more of it doesn't fall apart at this stage, because they haven't been able to replace spare parts. They haven't been able to repair pipelines. There's been considerable damage, of course, every few days caused simply by the U.S. and British bombing. And Iraq is not able to import many of the things it needs to repair these because of the sanctions regime itself, although there are a number of efforts to try and secure a few exemptions so that Iraq can at least invest some of the money into rebuilding its own infrastructure.
Did last week's UNICEF report showing that infant mortality had doubled in the last 10 years create a big stir at the UN?
In some ways, no. The United Nations has repeatedly, and UNICEF particularly, has repeatedly warned that infant mortality is rising, that there's a lack of medicines, there's a higher rate of malnutrition, of diseases like kwashiorkor, which is the wasting that is caused by malnutrition. At the same time, many of the countries that are hardline on the sanctions, such as the United States itself, of course, blame the problem largely on the Iraqi government. They've noticed, for example, that Iraq has been able to spend some money in terms of repairing the anti-aircraft batteries that have been fired on. What they're arguing is that very probably the Saddam Hussein government is relying on the sympathy for the children of Iraq and not doing as much as it could to help alleviate its own problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly, there was a time, I think it was a New York Times article a few days ago that seemed almost a time to the release of the new report on infant mortality that basically said that Iraq was spending very little of the money that it was getting in its oil sales to actually deal with health services for children. Is there any accuracy to that?
Well, the head of the UN office in Iraq, Benon Savan, has mentioned that there could be improvements made in the way that Iraq distributes food. However, Iraq does have to submit a distribution plan, a detailed distribution plan, to the United Nations about how it is going to spend the money it earns and where. And the UN approves these plans regularly. Simply put, the biggest problem is the sanctions, and the United Nations officials, including the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, have repeatedly placed the emphasis there, even though they themselves also admit that Iraq may be doing a less good job of providing for its people than it could be.
Now, with this situation of increasing infant mortality and continuing missile attacks, Juan, it makes sense that those who are involved in making U.S. policy might want to travel to Iraq to actually see the situation for themselves. But we found out this week that the State Department has actually blocked a trip by congressional aides to Iraq, where they were going to evaluate the impact of the sanctions on the Iraqi population. This was a delegation intended by several religious, Arab American, and peace organizations. The staffers were to meet with relief and UN officials. And the State Department, to us at least, has refused to comment exactly on the particulars. But people familiar with the delegation's work say that the department denied the aides special passport validations to go to Iraq after briefing them very sternly on the perils of such a trip. The U.S. imposed a travel ban on Iraq after the 1990 Gulf War, but U.S. nationals can apply for waivers, and that's what was at stake in this case. To discuss this part of the story, we're going to go to Phyllis Bennis, who is a Middle East expert for the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis Bennis, you were part of putting together this delegation's trip, which I know is not by any means called off. What is the status quo, and what happened in the last few days?
Well, essentially what we've seen, Laura, is an effort by the Clinton administration through a number of ways to first dissuade the aides from going and make it as legally and technically as difficult as possible. The administration does not have the right, of course, to prohibit travel. Travel is a constitutional right in this country. What they do have the right to do and what they have done is deny the passport validation that would make it legal to use a U.S. passport to travel to Iraq. That was their best effort so far to stop the aides from going. It's not a legal prohibition on travel, however, so it's we're hopeful that the delegation will be leaving in the next couple of days to investigate, as you say, both the impact of sanctions, the effect of the sanctions, and broader U.S. policy on U.S. strategic interests, things like the ability of U.S. farmers to sell grain to Iraq. Those kinds of direct U.S. aspects will be investigated as well. I think that what's clear is that in this period of deteriorating humanitarian situations, as we've seen through the UNICEF report that Farhan has discussed, and what is clearly an escalation in the U.S. military attacks, in the briefing, as you mentioned, by the State Department and the CIA, the aides were told over and over again that the only safety possible for such a trip would be to not go. In a further discussion I had with one of the State Department officials, she said that they were concerned that we understood that the real danger of such a trip was what she called friendly fire, and that it was only going to get worse.
Now, that's quite an admission. Has anyone been able to follow up on that, that they are warning U.S. representatives of friendly fire?
Well, as I questioned her at that time, I said, well, I asked her whether she was referring to a broadening of what had happened only 2 days before that conversation, which was the U.S. missile attack outside the no-fly zone, which had led to 19 civilian casualties in Iraq. And I asked her whether that was the model of what she meant by increasing danger. And she indicated that that particular attack was a one-time affair, that the pilot, in her words, had fired on an anti-aircraft site that was itself outside the no-fly zone, although the pilot, she claimed, and his plane was in the no-fly zone, but he was therefore authorized. I asked whether that represented an expansion of the rules of engagement, and she said no, it was the same rules of engagement, but that they were anticipating greater Iraqi provocations in this period in the so-called no-fly zones. She didn't say no, so-called, of course. And that they anticipated that they would, in her words, have no choice but to respond aggressively.
Phyllis, I have a question. Why is it that it's just congressional aides that are going and no members of the House of Representatives itself? You would think that given the importance of Iraq and U.S. foreign policy over the last decade, that some congressmen might be able to make time in their schedule to actually go themselves.
Well, I think you're right, Juan. This is a very important issue within U.S. policy, and we've been trying for a long time to encourage members of Congress to travel themselves. No member of Congress has gone to Iraq since 1991 when Representative Jim McDermott from, I believe, the Seattle area, did travel to Iraq. He's a physician and went to investigate health conditions.
Phyllis, I'm going to hold you there. We're going to come back to you in just a second. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear more from Phyllis, but also from five workers in Nebraska who say they were harassed because they're from Iraq. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be right back. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Laura Flanders here with Juan Gonzalez. Juan.
Yes, we'll continue in this discussion with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies on this congressional aides trip to Iraq. I'd like to ask Farhan Faq, have parliamentarians or political leaders from other European countries visited Iraq to find out what the results of this bombing, this nine-year bombing campaign has been?
Yeah, certainly. In fact, many of the prominent governments in the Security Council have had parliamentarians visiting Iraq fairly regularly, fairly frequently. Obviously, a lot of officials in the Russian government have gone. But also you have people such as members of the Labour Party in Britain, of the ruling Socialist Party in France. It seems that as if, in this case, the United States is the big exception, precisely because there's so few members of Congress who want to be tarred with the label of being soft on Iraq at this stage.
I would say that we're very optimistic that this trip by congressional aides would be preparatory for members of Congress going themselves. There have been, as we know, 44 members of Congress last fall who signed a Dear Colleague letter to President Clinton that was orchestrated by Representative John Conyers from Detroit that called for a delinking of sanctions in Iraq to end the economic sanctions, tighten the military sanctions, and we're hoping that that will increase and that some of those representatives and others will travel as well. The aides trip, these are assistants to the representatives who are going essentially as their eyes and ears, and in many ways we see this as a first step towards what we hope will be a delegation by members of Congress to investigate independently the impact and costs of this policy that has been in place virtually unexamined for almost a decade.
Now, Phyllis, what's really at question here seems to be that Congress is right to get information. And where are congressional people supposed to get their information when journalists are often criticized for being observed or followed or not given freedom inside Iraq? When non-government delegations go, they're criticized for being too friendly with the with the regime inside Iraq. How are people who are making policy and reviewing policies supposed to get their information?
Well, you know, Laura, that's a very interesting question. In one of the early memos that the State Department provided in answer to the request for passport validation, they seem to reverse a longstanding policy of discrediting United Nations reports. In one of the letters sent by the State Department, they tried to encourage the aides that rather than going to Iraq, that really wasn't necessary because, and I quote from the State Department letter of August 13th, because of the UN's central role in this program and its direct responsibility, et cetera, there is a wealth of reliable information available from the UN on humanitarian conditions throughout Iraq. They go on to say we would be happy to facilitate contacts for interested staff, and in fact, they did arrange a briefing of four staff of the State Department and two from the CIA to provide background, fear-inducing background, I would say, that focused virtually solely on the dangers that would face anyone traveling to Iraq. But nonetheless, this was a very interesting shift away from their condemnation and rejection of UN reports to one saying, well, there's all these great UN reports out there, so you don't really have to go on your own.
Juan?
And in terms of the prospects for any actual change in administration policy, if you say that there were several congresspeople who filed who sent a letter to the president, has that had any impact at all?
Not yet. We hope that in the next month or two, when Congress reconvenes, there will be a resolution put forward that will call more explicitly for the lifting of economic sanctions. Again, based on a delinking notion that real disarmament efforts, real military sanctions must be applied on a regional basis, going after the suppliers of weapon systems to Iraq and other countries in the region, rather than attempting to do it solely focused on Iraq from within, and that there will be support for that kind of a move within the Congress. It's been a very, very slow effort, not least because the level of demonization against the regime in Iraq, demonization, which is not necessarily inappropriate relative to the regime, has been somehow applied to the entire 23 million people who live in Iraq. So somehow it has become acceptable in the U.S. to make remarks as the famous one by Madeleine Albright of 1966, which she has still never repudiated, when she said that it was, quote, worth it that 500,000 children had died in Iraq as a direct result of the sanctions policy, which in her view was an appropriate price for whatever the sanctions have done in the disarmament field.
1996. On this question of the airstrikes, and more people are calling for an end to them, there was an editorial in the British Independent just yesterday. I had one question with respect to the UN, whose reports now apparently the State Department is looking at in a more positive light. If there is a threat of friendly fire to congressional delegations, is there not therefore also a threat to UN investigators, UN human rights workers, and humanitarian aid providers who do work and travel regularly to Iraq?
Absolutely. Aside from the several thousand Iraqi staffers of the United Nations programs in the country, there are also 400 internationals that are led by Hans von Sponeck, who is the director of the UN's humanitarian program in Iraq. I spoke with him a couple of days ago and raised this as a possibility for him to raise, and he said that he was very concerned about this, that if the military situation was escalating enough that U.S. officials were attempting to prevent even staff of the U.S. Congress from traveling to Iraq, that might indeed reflect I asked him whether he was concerned that might indeed reflect a danger for the humanitarian workers of the United Nations. I asked him whether the U.S. had informed him of this with an eye towards having him prepare to evacuate those members, for example, or at least to raise the issue within the Security Council to make a more informed decision. He said that he had not been informed of any such thing.
Farhan Haq, is that something you'll be raising at the United Nations or have others?
This has not been as big a concern within the Security Council as the sanctions itself. Basically, the major worry at the United Nations is simply that the current status quo is completely untenable. The United States had justified all these years of sanctions by pointing to Iraq's need to fulfill its disarmament tasks, to destroy what they suspected were arsenals of biological, chemical, or nuclear arms. Now, since last December, there have been no inspections. There are not going to be any inspections right now because the weapons inspectors have been kicked out of the country and will not be allowed back as the situation persists. So this current status quo is not even acceptable to the United States. And yet what you have here is no disarmament, but sanctions.
Farhan Haq, thank you very much for being with us here on Democracy Now! Farhan Haq is UN correspondent for the Interpress Service. We've also been speaking with Phyllis Bennis, Middle East expert for the Institute for Policy Studies. Meanwhile, also on the topic of what is happening to Iraqis around the globe, in Lincoln, Nebraska, five workers who say they were harassed by a supervisor because they are from Iraq have been awarded about $30,000 in a federal discrimination lawsuit. The men worked as meat cutters at an MI Industries business in Lincoln, an MI Industries factory in Lincoln. They said in the lawsuit that they were fired because their boss didn't like Iraqis. They also said that they had been told to take dog food home for their friends, denied medical attention after being injured at work, and assigned duties in the most dangerous part of the plant for reasons they thought had to do with anti-Iraqi bias. After the men complained about how they were treated, they were laid off and never hired back. We have with us Kathleen Neary, who is a lawyer representing these workers. She's with us from Lincoln. Kathleen Neary, thanks for coming on the program. What happened at MI Industries that resulted in this significant award to the five workers?
Right. What happened was that the five Iraqis that we represented had been very, very good workers and very loyal workers, and that in May of 1996, the defendant corporation hired a new plant manager who came in and, in my opinion, ruled with an iron fist, and that he took affirmative actions of a discriminatory and retaliatory nature against my clients, and that, in fact, they were treated in the most egregious and outrageous manner of anything I've ever heard of since I've been practicing law.
What is MI Industries? What do they make?
MI Industries is a corporation that buys meat byproducts from meatpacking plants and then turns these for example, cow tendons, into dog treats, pet treats, for primarily a Japanese market. And that's what primarily our clients were doing. They were assigned to do the most difficult work of cutting tendons with, and the allegations were, with dull scissors, while other non-Iraqi workers were provided adequate equipment.
Well, the award seems for five of them, $30,000 doesn't seem like a lot of money. Was there any reason particularly why the settlement was so low?
Well, there's a couple reasons. Mm-hmm. I think that you're dealing with a conservative Nebraska jury. I mean, we are in the Midwest, and we are very conservative here. I think there are two things that kept the verdict down. One is that our clients, these five Iraqi men, were hard workers, very hard workers, and as soon as they got laid off and fired, they went out and found new jobs within a period of a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So their back wages were de minimis. They were very small. And secondly, you have to remember that about a third to a half of the damages awarded were punitive damages. And that's the most significant thing about this case, because we know that punitive damages are intended to punish a wrongdoer for outrageous conduct. And the jury found their conduct was outrageous. So in other words, if our clients would have been slackers or not hard workers, the back wage award would have been much more significant. And possibly the punitive damages, it appears to me that the jury calculated the punitive damages based on a percentage of the back wages, then the corresponding punitives would have gone up as well. But we're pleased with the verdict. We're very pleased, and it took this Lincoln, Nebraska jury took a lot of courage and a lot of strength to stand up and say, we won't allow Iraqi workers or any workers to be treated in such a disrespectful and egregious manner.
Thank you very much, Kathleen Neary, who is a lawyer for Iraqi workers in Lincoln, Nebraska, who recently won a $30,000 award in a federal discrimination lawsuit due to how they'd been treated by MI Industries in Lincoln. We're going to continue with the topic of bias, harassment, discrimination, and those who are organizing to try to combat all three. An unusual coalition of religious groups representing Protestants, Roman Catholics, Jews, Mormons, and Muslims gathered this week in Colorado to brainstorm on how to win more acceptance for gays and lesbians within the religious community, how to create a space for gay and lesbian people inside the church so they don't have to leave it to be themselves. The coalition, which calls itself the National Religious Roundtable, is trying to forge a major public voice in support of gay rights to counter the homophobic rhetoric of religious conservatives. Organizers deliberately chose Colorado Springs because it's home to many conservative Christian organizations, including Focus on the Family, a Christian ministry that believes that homosexuality violates Christian principles. It's also home to organizers of Amendment 2, a 1992 ban on state laws intended to protect gays and lesbians from discrimination in the workplace. The roundtable was first organized in 1998 as a project of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force's Policy Institute and Equal Partners in Faith. We're going to talk first with Urvashi Vaid, who's director of the Policy Institute of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Urvashi, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Good to have you on the program. Tell us a little bit about this religious task force and your meeting this last week in Colorado Springs.
Sure. The National Religious Leadership Roundtable is truly a unique gathering of people that meets in an ongoing way and is, and it's a national network, an interfaith network of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, affirming religious organizations and leaders. In other words, it's not just gay and lesbian people who are in the circle, but it's pro-GLBT faith-based groups. And it was organized to counter the myth that's out there in our country that there's an opposition between religion and homosexuality, that somehow there's an inherent conflict between spirituality and sexuality. We don't think so. The members of the roundtable don't think so. And so the goal of this roundtable is to increase the gay-affirming voice in many, many, many faith-based denominations.
Rabbi Stephen Foster is from Congregation Emmanuel in Denver. He was present at the roundtable. Rabbi Foster, what did you get of it, and why were you committed to attend?
I was asked to speak on Monday evening. I've been involved in this issue for a long time. I had the privilege of serving as the chair of the No on Two campaign in Colorado. And I went because I believe in the fact that the gay community is entitled to and must be provided with equality and dignity in this country.
And Rabbi Foster, the choice of Colorado, given the high profile that that state got over the Proposition 2 and the calls actually for boycotts of the state that developed since then. Why did it get much attention within Colorado itself, the gathering?
Got very little attention in Colorado. I even looked at the papers yesterday, didn't carry very much about it. There was not very much press leading up to it.
Rabbi Foster, I disagree with you.
I was going to say...
one of the organizers of it, and Rabbi Foster was kind enough to be a speaker at our Monday evening program. The roundtable was extensively covered in the Colorado Springs Gazette, which is the local paper. And as it was covered in the New York Times.
Well, let's talk a bit.
But you asked about
the point
Colorado.
That I wanted to make, if I may, the point
there,
that I wanted to make, if
the
I might.
One second.
Let me just interrupt for 1 second. I'd like to talk, in fact, about the coverage. And I was impressed by the New York Times article that appeared in the paper yesterday. And the type of coverage that there has been had raised one question in my mind, isn't that it's often cast as a response to homophobic activity inside religious right and other religious congregations. And what I'm curious about is the work that you were doing inside your congregations, the congregations that you had contact to combat not just homophobia, but all sorts of attitudes to sex and sexuality that surely have harmed not just gay and lesbian people, but all sorts of people as they try to confront domestic violence, the epidemic of AIDS, and so on. Were those on your agenda also, Urvashi?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the members of the roundtable are organizations and religious leaders who have been engaged for a long time, 30 years, 25 years, within different denominations, Lutherans, Episcopals, Methodists, Catholics, and Jews, all a range of people who have been advocates inside their faith traditions for a different relationship to the gay and lesbian community. The issues that occur in different denominations range from the ordination of openly gay clergy and rabbis, which has been a struggle and continues to be in some places, to the sanctioning of same-sex unions by those faith-based groups. I mean, you may know that the Methodist Church is engaged in a vigorous debate about that, and approximately 68 pastors in the Methodist Church in California who performed a same-sex union are facing some legal consequence from the church. And Reverend Jimmy Creech, who was one of our guests at the roundtable and at the forum, is also somebody who has stepped out and taken on the consequences of having performed a same-sex union in opposition to his faith based the national body.
We actually have somebody on the line with us just joining the program, Reverend Gregory Dell, who was recently relieved of his position.
I was just going to say Reverend Dell is another example of this issue.
Well, he'll tell us about it. He's was a Methodist minister and was relieved of his position for performing, I believe it was 33 gay and lesbian ceremonies. And he recently became executive director of In All Things Charity, which is a gay rights group inside the Methodist Church. Speaking from Chicago, Reverend Dell, tell us about your experience. Why did you think it was important to perform those ceremonies, and when were you relieved exactly, very briefly?
Sure. I've been doing the ceremonies for about 18 years and doing them as a matter of course in my ministry because I see my ministry as extending to all people and certainly not discriminating against people because of their identity. It was only in 1996 when an ambiguous rule was passed prohibiting those services, and then in 1998 that rule was interpreted as binding. So it was the one service I did, the 33rd service in September of that year, that caused me to be brought to church trial, which convicted me, found me guilty of disobedience to the order and discipline of the United Methodist Church, and suspended me from my pastorate effective July 5th. So I've been suspended since the beginning of July.
Reverend Dell, this is Laura Flanders here with Juan Gonzalez. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll continue this discussion of fighting homophobia inside the church after this short break. We'll be back with you in a moment.
Welcome back to Democracy Now! We're talking here on the recent roundtable that was held in Colorado attempting to deal with bridging the gap that many Americans, unfortunately, misconception have of the conflict between spirituality and gay and lesbian members within the church. Reverend Dell, I'd like to ask you, have you seen any particular churches that are moving in a direction of greater acceptance and openness in terms of gays and lesbians within their congregations?
Well, certainly there are. I mean, there is, and among the so-called mainline denominations, the United Church of Christ as a denomination has taken some strides forward. I think it's important to note that all of the major Protestant Christian denominations are involved in this struggle of trying to discern ways to move through what for some people is a very painful, well, what many people is a very painful conflict. So there's progress in almost all of the mainline denominations, but very, very slow. There's a great deal of resistance.
Let's talk a little bit more about this roundtable itself, the National Religious Roundtable, and come back to Avishai Vaid, the director of the Policy Institute, which in part initiated this project. This is a culminatory sort of roundtable and a culminating event on a long-term process. What exactly or what did you find to be the major stumbling blocks as you move forward that you were apparently able to slide over to or work through to come to this point of agreement, Avishai?
Well, the process of bringing all of these diverse religious leaders and institutions together, we thought would be more difficult than it frankly has been. There has been a tremendous amount of common ground, despite different faith backgrounds and different traditions that individual members of the roundtable subscribe to. And so we have been able, within a year and a half period, to move to some fairly rapid consensus and agreement about the kinds of things this group wants to do. And the kinds of things the group wants to do is to, first of all, amplify the voice of a gay, lesbian, affirming faith movement. And, you know, to challenge the notion that there is this opposition inherent in every situation between religion and homosexuality. The second thing the roundtable is hoping to do is to provide a greater ability to support clergy like Reverend Dell and others who are facing trials and challenges for their ministry to gay and lesbian people. The New Ways Ministries founders, Sister Janine Gramick and Father Bob Nugent, are another example from another denomination of the kind of challenges that gay clergy or gay supportive clergy face. And another dimension of the roundtable is to actually engage in discourse and dialogue and discussion with our opponents on the religious right. Now, this is a really provocative and unusual stance to take. Most gay activists like me have not taken this stance, so I'm learning a great deal from working with the faith-based leaders about what it means to truly engage in discussion with people with whom you fundamentally disagree. And I would point to you the work of Reverend Mel White, whose organization Soul Force has been engaged in and had a breakthrough with Jerry Falwell. And Reverend White is organizing in October to go to Lynchburg to host for a joint meeting between hundreds of gay supportive people and Reverend Falwell's supporters, and the goal of the meeting is a dialogue. The roundtable is very interested in that kind of dialogue.
Rabbi Foster from Congregation Emmanuel in Denver, what will you do now to continue working on these issues as you go back to your congregation there?
Well, our congregation and people in the liberal movement in Judaism have been on board for a long time. We'll do everything we can. I'm one of those people who believes that this is a civil rights issue, and it ought to be framed as a civil rights issue. I think we get more people involved when it becomes a matter of civil and human rights and not viewed only as a gay rights issue, although the gay community is the community that is on the line at this point. I think when we broaden that perspective, we get more involvement of more people who see this as a religious cause.
Thank you very much. That's Rabbi Stephen Foster. We've also had with us on the line Avishai Vaid, the director of the Policy Institute, and Reverend Gregory Dell, who works now with all in all things charity, a United Methodist Rites gay group. We're going to go from one grassroots organizing effort to another, namely the one about community radio. The effort to move non-commercial radio forward, including Pacifica Radio's own struggle, has made headlines over the last 6 months, but the movement to increase community radio's reach and power is a global one, too. At a conference this last weekend in Maine, people from grassroots radio networks around the country held their fourth annual gathering, this time with guests from AMOC, an international coalition of community radio stations around the world. Frieda Worden was there from WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service. She's with us here in the studio. Frieda, in many parts of the world, radio is key to communication, information, and passing of knowledge from community to community, particularly in areas where illiteracy is high, and women in particular rely on this medium. Now, that's a global picture, as relevant elsewhere as it is here in the U.S. Was that the kind of thing you were talking about at the Grassroots Radio Conference?
Well, I actually gave the keynote address at the Grassroots Conference, and the subject that I talked about was the relationship of measuring and valuing unwaged work, which is a huge grassroots part of the global women's movement. You know, it's come from the grassroots into the international organizations, and comparing that and showing the relationship between that and volunteer activism within community radios. And as we, in the movement to measure and value unwaged work, say that the real point of this is that unwaged workers must be considered in decision of how the resources are going to be allocated. We made that same point about volunteer workers in radio stations. And the grassroots movement itself is an organization, or it's not actually an organization, it's simply an annual gathering of community radio stations that subscribe to a mission statement of diversity, community involvement, and volunteer participation, very heavy volunteer participation. So this was very apropos for them.
Well, it's an interesting topic because volunteer activity so often in our mainstream media culture is kind of put down or dismissed as charitable. And in the media world, it's particularly equated often with lack of professionalism in a world where huge multinational corporations control most of the airwaves. There's a struggling effort by some to maintain a non-commercial space that is often vigorously dismissed or treated as a kind of less professional effort. Is that the kind of thing your colleagues face?
You could say that this attitude about professionalism and hierarchicalization is not only affecting the airwaves, it's affecting the brainwaves. And this is a lot of the reason why we gather together to talk about these things, to reinforce each other. The stations that started the grassroots meetings, the grassroots movement, were those initially who had been on the receiving end of something called the Healthy Stations Blueprint Project. It was jointly sponsored by National Federation of Community Broadcasters and Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And the first thing that they were asked to do was to scrap their mission statement. And then some of the things that they were asked to do were to professionalize the station, to have consistency of voices on the air as much as possible, and to rely much more on national programming, especially from NPR, and play more music and have less local talk. And this was supposed to be something that would enable them to raise more money then for their stations. And I think that you can really see the influence of this way of thinking in the conflict that's come about in Pacifica as well.
Were you able to see, in terms of what is happening in other countries, whether there are any particular experiments or directions that are going against the tide of growing corporatization, even or attempts to corporatize even community radio?
Well, one of my favorites is the so-called radio listening clubs. There's a member of AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters Board, named Elizabeth Karanga, who lives in Zimbabwe. And she's told me on various occasions about a project that was started by professional women journalists in Zimbabwe, and it finally has spread to not only all of Southern Africa, but it's being done in India now. And they said, well, gee, we haven't heard the voices of the rural women very much. So they took tape recorders to the villages. They started recording these women's statements. And if they had questions for officials, they took those to the officials, and they put those things on the air. Then the people in the villages listened to this, were given tape recorders to record their own continuing comments, and then those went on the air. And so the radio listeners actually becoming regular participants on the radio, and that kind of dialogue coming from the bottom, if you forgive my using a hierarchical term, is really spreading in a lot of the developing world.
Coming back to the States for a moment, this is a situation, or we face a situation in which, since the passage of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, the price on the head of a radio license holder has soared with the elimination of the limits, more or less, total elimination of the limits on corporate ownership of a variety of media and number of radio licenses, even in the same market. What are the grassroots radio conference participants doing to preserve the security of their stations in that kind of an environment where some of them are being offered millions of dollars for their licenses even as they struggle to survive?
Well, of course, most non-commercial stations are actually in the non-commercial band, so they're not as likely to have a major offer for their license, although possibly one from a church, and that has happened.
The non-commercial band being at the margins of the FM or AM
wavelength. Well, it's on the left-hand side of the dial, and it was reserved for commercial stations explicitly by the federal government to prevent us from having to compete with the commercial licensees. Now, one thing that may happen, we don't know what's going to happen when a conversion to digital radio, you know, what kind of reservations there might be for that. And also, we're looking, as the World Association of Community Broadcasters, we're looking at the International Telecommunications Union, which is a body of the United Nations. We're trying to get them to recognize NGOs as part of the deliberations on how spectrum will be allocated internationally and what rules will apply, so that it won't just become a dialogue as it has become now, like the World Trade Organization, where it's only private industry and governments negotiating in the absence of any representatives of the people.
So the same fight about digital spectrum is taking place on radio as it has in television?
Well, the television digitization is being advanced ahead of radio, but the issue is still there, and the rest of the world is digitizing on radio, so it's bound to, the NAB is not going to hold it back forever. I think they're just waiting until the major corporations are able to in position to really seize as much as possible that spectrum.
Did you get any sense what impact the explosion of the internet has had on community radio, if any, in other parts of the world?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, AMARC, the World Association of Community Broadcasters, is sponsoring a project, and it has got some funding for a pilot, which will allow us to, especially it's going to start in the Latin American region, to exchange programming, actually audio files, between community radio stations. And this model is also happening among pirate radio stations, for instance, on anarchist websites. They're actually transferring programming that way. And I think that this is, that they've gotten ahead in the queue of the stations that use satellite, where all the stations have got to run around and catch the program out of the air at the same time. This way it stays on the computer and can be downloaded when you need it. And so the increasing efficiency of computers is making this possible.
The stations that take part or that offer space to the kind of programming you described taking place in rural parts of Africa and so on, how are they financed? Is there a greater alacrity by other governments to provide government funding to radio as a broadcast medium?
Well, in some cases, the government has set up a radio station to be used by the community, so they're not community radio in the sense that we have it. No, in general, government is not funding independent community radio stations. And I have to say the need for all the resources that we have in abundance here, or relative abundance here, is so much greater in the developing countries. That's one of the reasons, one of the aims of AMARC North America is to try to funnel some of our resources, even like used computers and all these things, to the radio broadcasters there.
As we draw to a close, Frieda Worden of Wings, I'd like to just ask you for a moment to describe the scene at the conference where it must have, I mean, I can only imagine that with so many community broadcasters, even within the Pacifica network, feeling at times so beleaguered from within and from without, to realize that you really are part, we really are part of a global community, must have been quite a rush.
It was hair-raising in the good sense, you know. It was wonderful. And we had a lot of Francophone broadcasters there, and it was just a wonderful feeling. And also Pacifica affiliates did get together at that conference to discuss how to present a united positive front in the Pacifica situation.
Well, thank you very much. If people want to get in touch with the World Association of Community Broadcasters or attend next year's Grassroots Radio Conference, do you have ideas of how they can do that?
Well, I don't have the email in front of me, but let them email me, wings@wings.org. That's W-I-N-G-S, wings@wings.org, and I'll definitely forward it to AMARC. I'm the Women's International Network representative for North America.
Thank you very much. Frieda Worden, as she said, is the Women's International Network delegate at AMARC from WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service, which is located, I believe, still in Austin.
Yes.
That's right. Thanks, Austin. This is it, just about, for Democracy Now! Today. The program has been produced, as always, by Maria Carrion and David Love. If you want a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. Our website is www.pacifica.org. Our technical director is Errol Maitland from the studios of WBAI in New York. We had engineering today from Bernard White. Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders with Juan Gonzalez today. Thank you for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!